Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 8, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss class action litigation, settlements, attorney's fees, Cypre, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. Very pleased to welcome returning guest Ted Frank. He's a senior attorney and director of the Center for Class Action Fairness at the Competitive Enterprise Institute right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to give us some opening remarks on the topic for about 10 to 15 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking for questions from the audience. So with that, Mr. Frank, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this. They say that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client, so I suppose you should take everything I say with the appropriate grain of salt. As I discuss Frank versus Portner, the cert petition I've brought with Tom Goldstein before the U.S. Supreme Court. The issue is one of class action settlements and the underlying conflicts of interest therein. A class action settlement is different from a regular settlement in that you have absent parties at the table who are affected by the settlement, the absent class members whose claims are being waived in exchange for whatever relief the settlement provides. But the parties negotiating for the settlement have their own incentives. The defendant, of course, wants to get a settlement that costs it as little as possible, and the attorneys who are negotiating simultaneously for class relief and for their own fee, or maybe sequentially, but at any rate, they're hoping to maximize their own recovery and their own share of the recovery from the settlement. And every dollar that eventually goes to the class is a dollar that the defendant isn't going to want to pay in attorney's fees down the road, whether or not it's done sequentially or at the same time. To protect against this, courts have a fairness hearing and make sure that absent class member rights are protected and are required to certify the settlement as fair, reasonable, and adequate. However, class counsel and the parties have various tools for obscuring the allocative decisions that get made between class counsel and class recovery, and they can subtly trade benefits to defendant for bigger fees. These tools primarily function by creating artificial inflation of the settlement's apparent relief, which in turn justifies outsized fee requests when, in fact, the class is getting very little. So the classic example of this is the coupon settlement. The defendant agrees to give coupons to the class. The attorneys say, look, we've given tens of millions of dollars of coupons to the class, and therefore we're entitled to a big fee. But in reality, maybe 1 to 3% of coupons get used, or even less, and the settlement looks much bigger than it is, and in fact, the class attorneys are getting the vast majority of the benefit. But you need that sort of illusion of relief before a court will actually award big fees, or before you can fool a court into awarding big fees. If you go to a court and say, we have a $10 million settlement of these alleged consumer fraud claims, and the attorney is going to keep $9 million of it for themselves and distribute $1 million to the class, even the laziest judge is going to say, wait a second, why are the attorneys getting the vast majority of the relief? So for class counsel to maximize their recovery, they need to do things to create the illusion of relief. Coupon settlements are well-known means of doing that, but they've gotten less popular as attention has been paid to them, and after the Class Action Fairness Act restricted the way attorneys' fees could be calculated on coupons. But there are still a number of other tricks that are used to inflate apparent settlement value so that, in fact, the class attorneys are getting the vast majority of the benefit. A common means of doing this is the claims-made settlement. You go to the court and we say we're going to make available $3 or $6 to every class member, and since there are 7 million class members, this is really a $42 million settlement. But the thing is with claims-made settlements, they're like coupon settlements in that very few class members ever actually make claims, either because they didn't get notice or the claims process is used to deter class members from making claims, or it's just not worth the time and effort for a class member to make a claim for $6 or some small amount of money. And so we've typically found that claims are usually much less than 10% and often even less than 1%. Another way of exaggerating class relief is through what's called CyPre, and that's using the class action mechanism to give money to a third-party charity rather than to the class. However, what frequently happens is that the charity is related to the class counsel. So, in fact, the class counsel is getting paid twice, once with the attorney fee, once with a payment to, say, their alma mater. Or, as happened in this case, the defendant's charity, the defendant is already giving money to a charity, and then they're just using the class action settlement to, say, to change the accounting entries and take credit and allow the attorneys to take credit for donations that the defendant was making anyway for marketing reasons. Another way to create the illusion of relief is to take credit for some sort of injunction. You see this most often in merger and acquisition class actions where there's some brand new disclosure pursuant to an injunction, and the attorneys say that this disclosure is worth a lot of money to the class and we should get attorney's fees. Courts have started to see through all of these things. In the merger and acquisition context, the injunctions are for disclosure without any payment to the class. Delaware courts are are becoming increasingly skeptical about that and have spoken out against it and have started reducing attorney's fees in those cases and started threatening to reject those settlements entirely. And the Center for Class Action Fairness has had a lot of success on the other two areas. In particular, in a Judge Posner decision in the Seventh Circuit in 2014 called Pearson versus NBTY, that was a settlement where the class got $800,000 or so, and the attorneys got over $2 million for themselves because, again, it was a claims process and very few class members made claims, less than 1%. And they tried to take credit for that. They tried to take credit for some CyPre. They tried to take credit for an illusory injunction that didn't actually accomplish anything. They went to the district court and they said the settlement is worth tens of millions of dollars because that's the amount of money we made available to the large class. Judge Posner rejected that and said, no, the settlement is worth the $800,000 that you actually paid to class members. And when you compare the $800,000 to the $2.1 million that the attorneys got, that's an abuse of the class action system because you've created a class action settlement where the attorneys are the primary beneficiaries. So we objected to this Duracell settlement in the in Florida District Court because it used just about every trick in the book to sort of exaggerate class relief. I mentioned the idea of a claims-made settlement where the attorneys say, look, there are 7 million class members and we're offering them $6 each if they make a claim, so the settlement's worth $42 million. But here the parties admitted that they knew that over 99% of the class wouldn't make any claims, and in fact, only $340,000 was getting paid out while the attorneys were asking for $5.7 million for themselves. They also tried to justify the settlement by pointing to $6 million retail value of batteries that Duracell would be giving to Toys for Tots and to first responders. However, Duracell already had advertising campaigns where they gave those batteries or gave first responders and Toys for Tots and other similar charities free batteries, and the fact that this settlement requires them to give $6 million of batteries over 5 years isn't adding anything because Duracell was doing that anyway. So we argued that that wasn't any sort of incremental benefit to the class, even to the extent that you could take credit for Cypre. And then third, they take credit for an injunction that Duracell had to agree not to make certain claims on labels for the Duracell Ultra battery. And we complained about that as illusory also because, as we noted, Duracell didn't sell Duracell Ultra batteries anymore. They had discontinued them a year before the settlement. And now they sell Duracell Quantum batteries, where they make the exact same claims that they were allegedly making fraudulently on the Duracell Ultra batteries. But the injunction didn't do anything about Duracell Quantum batteries. It just did, just affected the Duracell Ultra battery that had been discontinued. And we argued that just like an injunction over advertising claims about New Coke or the Edsel automobile or Zima beverages, it doesn't really matter when Duracell agrees not to say anything about Duracell Ultra batteries. We've had success in challenging these. Every time we brought one up to an appeals court, the Seventh Circuit rejected a much better settlement than the $5.7 million to $340,000 ratio we saw in this one. The Sixth Circuit rejected a similar settlement in Ray Drymax Pampers in 2013. The Ninth Circuit remanded for a reduction in attorney's fees in the Bluetooth settlement in 2011. We expected similar success in this case, Portner versus Gillette, when we took it to the 11th Circuit. But much to our surprise, the 11th Circuit rubber-stamped what the district court did and held it wasn't an abuse of discretion, held that it was perfectly okay to have a claims-made settlement where the class didn't actually get paid, held it was okay to give credit to Cypre for what Duracell had already been doing, and said that the district court was entitled to find that the injunction was valuable to the class. So we have a very interesting circuit split that we're taking to the Supreme Court. We filed our cert petition December 11th, and we expect briefing to be done sometime in early March. And the Supreme Court has previously indicated that they're interested in the Cypre issue, and we hope they're interested in the entirety of this Rule 23E issue and the abuse of class action attorneys taking the settlement process to benefit themselves over their putative clients. Again, I thank the Federalist Society for giving me this opportunity to talk about this case, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Let's turn right away to audience questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Ted Frank, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple caller questions right off the bat here, but before we go to those, let me ask you, Ted Frank, about the 11th Circuit. Did that ever go en banc, or was that a three-judge panel?
It was a three-judge panel, and they made it an unpublished decision. And the 11th Circuit indicates that they disfavor en banc petitions for unpublished decisions. So we weren't comfortable taking it en banc, and we decided to just go straight to the Supreme Court.
Okay. And one other quick factual question, if I could. You mentioned the ratio here, the $5 million to $300,000 in terms of payout to the $344,000, I guess, in terms of payouts to the class itself. Were those numbers stipulated too, especially the 344 number?
It was fascinating. Plaintiffs and defendants argued that it was completely irrelevant how much class members actually got, and offering $6 to a class member is exactly the same as hand-delivering $6 to a class member in terms of valuing a settlement. The judge did order disclosure of the number, and they got and that's how we discovered it was 344,000. But fascinatingly, they included with that a declaration from the settlement administrator saying, look, we do hundreds of these, and when you have this sort of settlement, you can expect that less than 0.5% of the class members will ever make a claim, and that's what happened here. And we found that fascinating because the year before, in 2013, I think, the Chamber of Commerce issued a study where they tried to figure out how much class actions actually pay class members. And they had a lot of trouble because this is something that everybody hides. The plaintiff's bar hides, and nobody discloses it, and judges don't ask for this information. And so they only had a data set of 6 settlements, and with that data set, they guessed that the number of class members that recovered was about 1.5% on average. And so they got a lot of criticism for releasing this study. How dare you do this with a data set of only 6, with a sample size of only 6 settlements? And how dare you say it's only 1.5%? So it was really entertaining to see this smoking gun where they admit that, yes, the chamber was wrong with 1.5%. They were being too generous to the plaintiff's bar, and the actual number is much, much lower than that. So if nothing else, we've exposed sort of how many of these class actions are ripoffs. And now it's up to the courts to take the additional step in saying, but that's not how class actions are supposed to work.
I do want to get to the audience questions, but I'm intrigued by this. And you mentioned that the courts don't know these numbers a lot of times. Can you say a few words about the role of the court and the responsibility of the court in class action litigation? There are named plaintiffs, of course. There are unnamed plaintiffs. Those are the folks I guess we're talking about who really don't have a lot of influence in how the case is conducted. My understanding is the system relies on the courts to make sure, and the judges to make sure, that those unnamed plaintiffs are being treated fairly. If they don't have an awareness of how much money these folks are not just being awarded, but actually how much they're getting, what sort of recovery they're getting, how can they make an assessment at the point where they approve the settlement that it meets the elements of fairness that might be required?
Well, the problem is that this has been going on for decades, and so there are all these barnacles of precedent because, well, let's step back. You have an we have an adversary justice system, and courts rely. You have plaintiffs on one side, you have defendants on the other, and they will zealously represent their clients and raise all the relevant issues, and from that we'll know how to rule. But when you have the class action settlement process, suddenly you have the plaintiffs and defendants on the same side telling the court, hey, we have this great settlement, and it's good for plaintiffs and it's good for defendants, and you should approve it. And suddenly the court's role has changed from an adversary process to an investigatory process, and judges aren't used to having that role. And not only that, their incentive is, well, if I approve the settlement, settlements are good, and my docket's a lot less complicated, and the chief judge is bothering me less that I have so many cases on my docket and so many decisions that haven't been made, and they're offering to take all these complexity out of the way, and settlement is good, and they both tell me it's a good settlement, and I'm going to approve it. And class members have the right to object to an unfair settlement, but the problem is that just as individual class members don't have the interest in bringing a $6 consumer fraud claim unless it's completely aggregated, individual class members who are subject to a settlement and get some complicated notice in the mail, they don't have the incentive to complain to the court, and if they do, they probably, you know, they certainly don't have the incentive to pay tens of thousands of dollars to a lawyer to make the strongest arguments against the settlement, and most lay people will not realize that the illusions that the parties are doing are fair or unfair. The legal press is largely unaware of these illusions, and it's fascinating that I've seen three different newspaper stories in the legal press, and these are presumably above average educated people relative to the rest of the lay people who are members of the class, are describing this as a $50 million settlement. And where's $50 million come from when the attorneys are getting $5.7 million and the class is getting $300,000? And the answer is the parties issued a press release saying this is a $50 million settlement because we made $6 available to 7 million people, even though they knew that there was absolutely no chance that Duracell was going to pay out anywhere near $50 million.
How do things like that get reported on publicly traded companies' books? I mean, does it get reported as a $50 million?
I'm sure it gets treated as a $350,000 liability, where they set aside, the $6 million for the attorney's fees and the expected number of claims. Or maybe they set aside $50 million as a potential liability and then immediately return $44 million of it back to the books. But most of these settlements are generally too small to be are under what the SEC requires to be disclosed at the line level. I couldn't tell you what the accountants are doing at the line item. I mean, that would be interesting. But again, that's part of the opacity of the process. Where we've had success is that we do this as a nonprofit, and so we pick cases where we can hopefully generate precedent and hopefully encourage district court judges to give these more scrutiny and what they should be looking out for when they're evaluating these settlements and to not take at face value that when the parties come to them and say, we have a $50 million settlement, maybe you should look at it a little closely and see that it's really a $340,000 settlement.
Very good. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Where we once had two questions, we now have one. So let's take our first call of the day now.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. Over the last 40 years or so, dating back to my law school bar exam days, I've received probably 6 or 8 notices in the mail that I was a member of a particular class action. In all but 2 cases, I took no action because it wasn't worth the time. In one case, I responded with the information just to make the point of having someone pay out the $6.44 or whatever it was offered to each class member to make sure that at least one class member got that. In another case, I wrote a very long and detailed letter to the judge down in Texas, if I recall correctly, expressing all my objections to the proposed settlement and the reasons why the attorney's fee request was absolutely ludicrous, and received no response. And my question is, apart from raising these issues with the courts, is any attention being given to redoing or repealing the class action statute in Congress? Because it seems largely to be a collusive device that in which the plaintiff's attorneys and the defendants seem to have the same interest in just closing off potential claims and pocketing some money and leaving people who might actually have a real grievance out in the cold.
It's hard to say that there's that sort of appetite in Congress, and in certainly the regulatory apparatus is operating in the opposite direction. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is looking to issue regulations forbidding credit card companies from having arbitration clauses that allow them to opt out of class actions, basically, by giving an alternative dispute resolution that allows them to reduce costs by avoiding all the nonsense of what's happening in the class action system. And you see a case a year in the Supreme Court where some state court is refusing to, or some lower court is refusing to enforce an arbitration clause. There's a lot of resistance in the legal community to just having freedom of contract to opt out of the class action system. So the idea of just actually getting rid of class actions isn't there, and I think it's important to understand that, you know, the class action system was originally devised as sort of a civil rights mechanism to give people a way of group together claims against the government, and it's since been translated into something to be used to extract money from defendants. Sometimes the defendants have done wrong, sometimes they haven't. You can usually tell by the nature of the settlement. Because sometimes you do have settlements where the defendants are actually paying real money to real people. And I think that's actually happening much more often in the last couple of years than when I started doing this in 2009, simply because of the precedents we've won that looked askance at the $0 settlement. So I think we see a lot fewer $0 settlements, though. If this 11th Circuit decision holds, nothing stops parties from suddenly refiling their class actions in a Florida or a Georgia district court and getting the favorable treatment that the 11th Circuit gives to class counsel versus the scrutiny that the 6th or 7th or 9th Circuit gives these things. So the short answer to your question is no. You're not going to see class actions go away. And I don't think class actions should go away. I think they do have a purpose, and just the corrupt class actions should go away, and the corrupt class action settlements should go away.
Well, that touches on a brief follow-up, if I may. Is there anything in the record before the court on this case that deals with class actions that actually achieve some benefit for the purported class that you would not categorize as quote-unquote corrupt?
Well, I mean, that's not an issue before. I mean, nobody is asking to abolish class actions. Nobody's asking to abolish class action settlements. They're just saying what we're asking for is that courts should give the same sort of scrutiny to these things that Judge Posner demands, that the attorney should not be the primary beneficiary, and that you should treat illusory relief as illusory rather than granting the fiction that a defendant that does something that doesn't affect its relationship with the class members in any way isn't any sort of benefit to the class members or any sort of compensation to the class members for the waivers of their claims.
Thank you.
We've got three questions pending now, so let's move right to our next question.
Your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor.
Hi, I'm Jack Hansen in the Boston chapter. Frank, I'm curious whether, Mr. Frank, curious whether there's any aspect of the rules of professional responsibility, and in particular the prohibition on conflicts of interest that might be relevant in this analysis of lawyers and who they're advocating for, whether for themselves or for their client. Thank you.
I would agree that I'm getting an echo now.
I'm getting that echo too. Excuse me, Ted. Let me just mute the caller's phone and see if that helps. Try again.
I would agree that it's a potential ethical violation. However, I think taking it to professional responsibility is a problem because you have a court saying this is fair, reasonable, and adequate, and And I think if I took it to took this sort of conduct to a professional responsibility review board or a bar, they would not want to second guess those decisions. And and then you just sort of have the notice problem. Everybody has been doing it this way for decades because courts have been letting them, and we're finally starting to peel that back, and courts aren't doing this. I think it would be interesting for somebody to take some time when somebody is repeatedly doing this, and I have one set of attorneys in mind where we've won a case against them, and the Seventh Circuit criticized them, and they're still structuring settlements the exact same way, but they're just form shopping them away from the Seventh Circuit. And I'm considering whether to bring that before an ethics board, but I think their defense will be, but the court said that this was fair, reasonable, and adequate. So I think we need to win this in the courts first. Because my feeling about professional review boards is that they tend to work in favor of the legal profession, and that legal ethics is sort of an oxymoron given what professional responsibility groups consider ethical and what lay people might consider ethical. So if you have a court signing off on these things, why is that unethical? So I think we need to win this in the courts first or somewhere else.
We've got two questions pending before we go to the next call. Let me make an announcement about our upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Next week, we have a Courthouse Steps Teleforum on Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, recapping the Friedrichs oral argument. That's Monday at 2. Then on Wednesday at 3, we'll be talking about standing to sue, particularly as it relates to suits brought by the states and the state AGs. That's Wednesday at 3. Thursday at 2, our teleform will be about judicial selection. And then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll have the first Michael Lewis Memorial teleform. So it's a full schedule. Check your emails and check the website for changes and for additional upcoming calls. Of course, today we're talking to Ted Frank. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yes, it's David Emerson, society member in Berkeley. Great discussion. And Dean, I want to echo your suggestion about looking at what the accounting profession is doing in regard to these settlements, insofar as, you know, there's a reasonable amount that we booked as a liability. And it would not be reasonable to book the full amount and reverse that in a subsequent quarter, as that would give an unrealistic image of what the company's balance sheet would look like. I wouldn't be surprised if the big four accounting firms actually have a process, procedure, and guidelines in place, and that may be a useful place to mine for some additional information. My question is actually twofold. One has to do with the whether or not there's any, I guess, merit to re-looking at the class action process and the automatic deemed opt-in of the class members, and thinking that again about, since the ratio of in to out versus participants and claims made is so low, is it actually reasonable to deem that people are actually opting in for this kind of representation? And then the second question has to do with more about just the sheer magnitude of the legal fees that are racked up in these cases. Some of them don't seem to be particularly difficult, and yet perhaps the legal fees are ginned up to excessive amounts, and whether there's actually something else to be looked at in addition to the participation on the claims made.
Yeah, those are two separate issues. Certainly every other country, when they're considering whether to have some sort of aggregate litigation procedure, the first thing they say is, but we don't want it to be anything like what the United States is doing. And one of the things they say is, we need to make it opt-in rather than opt-out. Is there any sort of political movement to have that here. I don't think there's the willpower. We set it up as an opt-in system. You have a special interest group, lawyers, that benefit mightily from having it done that way, and I don't think there's political willpower to get a change to an opt-out system. Though, you know, maybe down the road that will happen if it turns out that you can't have a class action system without it being as corrupt as it is. And on the attorney's fees issue, I mean, that's another thing that my nonprofit looks at. And we've uncovered some really tremendous abuses, cases where the parties come in and say, look, we've billed $50 million in fees and we've investigated, and it turns out that a large part of that is hiring $25 an hour temp lawyers to sit in a warehouse and click on buttons as they're looking at documents, and they're really just doing ministerial tasks that a high school graduate could be doing, but they're billing them out at $500 an hour. Billing the class members $500 an hour and then asking for a multiplier on top of that. And in other cases, the case settles and then they hire dozens of these $25 an hour lawyers to work 60 hours a week re-reviewing documents or summarizing depositions so that they could bulk up the lodestar for their attorney fee request. Or we got some discovery in a TCPA class action, that's a Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And, you know, our sense was is that these are very straightforward class actions, and they either get dismissed right away or settled right away if they can't get dismissed right away, because nobody wants to bet the company on the 99% chance that they'll win, and so they'll settle for a penny on the dollar. And indeed, we found that the lawyers were recovering 61% of the time. They would devote an hour to a case, and they had a 61% chance of recovery, but they were asking for fee requests with a multiplier of 10, and getting slightly less than that. So win or lose, they were averaging over $1,500 an hour. And, you know, we're hoping for an opportunity to take that up to an appellate court. And unfortunately, the last time we had a client, he was paid to fire us, which I think is its own ethical problem, but the Seventh Circuit didn't want to do anything about it, so there was nothing we could do, and we just need to have some sort of procedure in advance to prevent that from happening, which we usually do by having one of our own attorneys object, and then I can't be bought off. But, you know, there's a lot of corruption in the system that has been happening, and usually the defense we see is, oh, but everybody does it this way, to which we respond, yes, that's the problem. So, you know, this is what we're challenging in Frank versus Portner, is only one aspect of all of the problems in the class action settlement system, and how attorneys are sort of extracting wealth from their putative clients. But hopefully we can attack some of these other issues over time as cases present themselves.
We've got just one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take another call.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Frank. My name is Hayden O'Byrne. I'm an attorney with the Miami Lawyers Chapter here in Miami, Florida. And also, I handle some class action defense work down here for K&L Gates. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, when I've looked at these, and actually in your work, that seems to, you know, to me, that would seem like it would really drive the bus here if you could get it done, is what, you know, how successful have you been in getting judges to push back a fee hearing until after the claims made settlement deadline has closed, so that then the judge can make the fee determination based on the number of claims actually made, as opposed to doing some sort of Reynolds analysis or a watered-down version in another circuit that's coming up with some with an estimated value. Because at the end of the day, with an estimated value, it's always going to be an estimate.
Well, in I think it was Redmond versus Radio Shack, a Seventh Circuit case, we got Judge Posner to say, you should do exactly what you say and find out what the exact actual claims recovery is and then have the hearing. So we've had success on the issue. We had a Third Circuit case where the judge just refused to make any findings about it or ask any information about it, and the Third Circuit said in the case In Re Bio Products antitrust litigation, that's a 2013 case, no, you have to figure out what the direct recovery is, and that's a factor in the fairness of the settlement. And it turned out that the class was only getting $3 million or less than $3 million, and the attorneys were getting $14 million. And so they sent that back down. And instead of $15 million going to charities associated with the attorneys, it's now going to the class. You know, when appellate courts step in, suddenly, I think it's interesting, when appellate courts step in, what we see is that the class actions where the defendants, you know, where there's a partially meritorious or even entirely meritorious claim, suddenly the settlement's renegotiated and the class is getting money now. And in the entirely frivolous class actions where it's only being brought to sort of hold up the defendants and it's being settled for $0 in attorney's fees, when the courts reject those settlements, suddenly the class action goes away because you can't get a settlement where the class gets paid and the attorneys get paid and the defendant isn't willing to fight or it's cheap enough that the defendant doesn't prefer to fight. If you view class actions as a means of deterrence, you should like what we're doing because it means that the good class actions are extracting more than the bad class actions are, and that's exactly what you want in terms of deterrence, because otherwise it doesn't matter whether you're a good actor or you're a bad actor because you're getting hit with class actions either way. So I've digressed a little bit, but we've had some success on that, but I think Portner versus Gillette in the 11th Circuit was a big setback, and we haven't been involved in these cases, but I've seen three cases since Portner versus Gillette came down where the judge said, you know, I'm not even going to look at what the class recovered because Portner versus Gillette says it doesn't matter if the class recovery is tiny. I can approve the settlement anyway, so I'm going to do it. So it doesn't matter what the class gets. And I think that's exactly why the Supreme Court needs to look at this, because nobody is going to want to bring their class action settlements in the Third Circuit if they can bring it in the 11th Circuit and avoid that scrutiny, or the 7th Circuit and avoid that scrutiny. So you have a real circuit split here, and you have it on an issue that the Supreme Court has previously said that they care about. So I'm very optimistic that we have a chance of getting this petition granted.
Yeah, and I think I disagree with you that with respect to the value of all of these and the cost benefits. I mean, I think most of these are just legal extortion. You know, from being on the defense side, it's, you know, people come up with, you know, the smallest, tiniest product defect. You know, maybe there's crust that forms on the ring of your, you know, shower faucet after 8 years, and you can make a class action out of it. It's not anything that anybody cares about. And if you're defending those cases, they're millions and millions of dollars to defend. And the only way that you can get out of it is to play the blood money to the plaintiffs and hope that you can get a settlement. And it would be great if somebody, you know, I wish that more objectors would object to the class, to the fees at the back end, so that the settlement's in place, the relief goes to the class members. To the extent that anybody cares about, you know, the mislabeled whatever it is, or the, you know, the crust that develops on your shower head or the ring around your bathtub or the fact that, you know, dirt gets stuck in your shoes or any of those tiny little things that the class actions are about nowadays, and that people that want to make the claims will do so, even though it's usually only 0.5%, because people just don't care. And the fee award is challenged at the end in a substantive way so that it actually goes forward. And then if I can just make one other point to the caller from Chicago at the beginning of the call, HR 1927, which I think is more focused on asbestos class actions, I think that just went through the House and Obama threatened to veto it yesterday. I was looking at that more in terms of the fact that now the asbestos bankruptcy trust records will be out there and the plaintiff's attorneys can't hide them, because what had been happening in the asbestos litigation was the plaintiffs would file trust affidavits saying that they'd been exposed to all the bankrupt companies, and then in depositions against the solvent companies, they would say that they'd never worked with anything from the bankrupt companies, and there was no way, because the trust documents were shielded, there was no way of getting those documents. If there's a Garlock bankruptcy case in Georgia that goes through a lot of the details, but that is working its way through Congress now, and I think it'll have a broader impact on class actions if it goes through.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Obama is going to veto a bill that makes a very tiny change to the class action system is exactly why I don't think we're going to see the sort of major reforms, at least not without a 60 senator majority and a Republican president. I think we were very lucky to get the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005 through, which essentially makes possible what I'm doing, because now these class action settlements are largely in federal court. And, you know, when we try objecting in, say, Missouri state court, they don't care at all. So we get no traction there, and we've sort of restricted ourselves to federal court. But certainly there are a good number of extortionate class actions over things much sillier than the shower rings. And I could talk for an hour on just those that we've objected to. I have an objection pending in the subway foot long settlements, which is another $0 settlement. And you can tell which are the extortionate ones, because those are the ones that don't actually pay the class anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you mentioned another one. Pampers Drymax was another good one. But, yeah, there's tons of them out there.
Yeah, we have another appeal pending in motor fuel litigation, which alleges that every single purchaser of gasoline in the United States is a victim of consumer fraud because the vendors didn't disclose at their gas station the basic sixth grade physics that liquid expands with temperature. So in a hotter day, you get fewer molecules per gallon. So if it's a consumer fraud case based on Avogadro's law, basically. But again, that settled for $0, but the attorneys are seeking tens of millions of dollars for that one.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, we still got a few minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one more question, so let's carry on.
Mr. Frank, Doug Seaton in Minneapolis, I'm wondering what would be a legislative solution. I know you're thinking that this battle really has to be fought out in the courts and not in the ethics boards either, but what might a legislative solution look like to the problem if there were to be such a thing or could be such a thing?
I haven't given great thought about that, because when it came to coupon settlements, the legislative solution that Congress came up with is that, well, courts need to ensure that a coupon settlement is fair, reasonable, and adequate. But that's what Rule 23E already says. So I think my sense now is that you don't need a legislative solution. You already have the rules in place, and just courts have to follow it. And they have to recognize what's happening. And if they're not inclined to do that, they're not going to be inclined to follow any legislative solution that comes out of Congress. But you know, down the road, if the Supreme Court says we don't want to get involved, or it's entirely up to the discretion of district court judges, then you need to structure legislative solutions that cabin the discretion of the district court judge. What Texas did was class action attorneys can only get paid the same way that class members get paid. So if the class members get paid in coupon, the class action attorneys get paid in coupons. But that didn't make its way through Congress when they tried that, and what we ended up with the legislative compromise of the Class Action Fairness Act. So it's not clear that a legislative solution is feasible, but even if it was feasible, I'm not sure that it matters unless we change the jurisprudence and the way courts look at these things.
Thank you.
Well, Ted Frank, thank you so much for joining us here today. I think we've exhausted the questions from the audience, and I appreciate your time and wish you the best going forward. To our audience, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, when we'll be recapping the oral argument in much-talked-about Friedrich's case. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.